Now we take our Bibles and we turn to our text today, which is in the book of Exodus. You remember we're studying about Moses. Moses is the eighth example of faith in Hebrews 11. We have studied the book of Hebrews and really slowed down now that we've gotten to this 11th chapter, talking about the individuals who are examples of faith in that 11th chapter. So we're talking about Moses, and this is maybe message number 5 or 6 on Moses. I didn't count them up, but I think that's about right. Well, here's what I see about Moses. What I see is that God is, first of all, calling him to faith. So for him to be put in the category of faith, he had to be called to faith. And then all of this calling has to do with preparing him for what God has for him to do. So the first thing we saw in the last part of chapter 2 was that God gave to him contentment. When God calls us to faith, he calls us to contentment. He calls us to have peace in our heart, to be at rest. And so he gave to Moses contentment. The second thing that we saw was that God gave to him revelation. God revealed to him, first of all, who he was. He began to spell out a little bit about his own names, the names of God by which he is to be known. And then we saw that God gave to Moses a calling, and this calling resulted in Moses coming to Christ. And that third chapter concluded with God telling him the victory that is his. And that's what the gospel always does. The gospel, yes, has warnings, but most of all, the gospel is a very, very positive and wonderful message to tell us about how our sins were forgiven and our guilt was taken away and our condemnation was removed. And God was able to look upon us in the person and the work of Christ as forgiven sinners and sinners that are under grace. And we know that it is altogether by his mercy and by his grace that we are saved, and we look nowhere else but to him. So it's a very wonderful message, and that is the message that is given to Moses. Well, then what do we come to when we come to the fourth chapter? What I see here is that God gave to Moses an education. So he's given to him contentment, and he's given to him revelation, and he's given him a calling, and now he's going to give to him an education. So I want you to follow with me, please, as we study along through this fourth chapter. But we first of all need to back up into the third chapter, because I want you to see something of what begins things. First of all, in verse number 10, you have a calling that comes to Moses that Moses is startled by. In 3:10, God said, "Come now, therefore, and I will send you unto Pharaoh." Now, if he had just stopped with "come," Moses probably would have been as happy as he could be, because Moses was happy to come to God. But then he tells him, "I'm going to send you to Pharaoh. And furthermore, I'm going to send you to the children of Israel, and you're going to be my instrument to deliver them out of Egypt." Well, I wasn't there, but the idea that we get is that Moses is absolutely startled. He's an 80-year-old man, so he's well experienced. He's well grounded. He is settled in every way, but when God tells him what he's going to do, Moses is completely unsettled by this. And so what I want to show you are a series of protests that come from Moses. And the first protest is in verse number 11. In verse number 11, Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" So the first thing he does is he tells God, "I am without importance." He asks the question, "Who am I? What abilities have I? I don't have anything to do this." So he protests on the basis, first of all, of his own unimportance. And then he protests with a second thing in verse number 13. And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and I say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they say unto me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? So what Moses is doing here is, he is saying, I am without authority. So I have no importance. Who am I? And I have no authority. Who are you? And then God tells him what his authority is. And we spent a fair amount of time talking about this last week. God said to Moses in verse 14, Your authority is very simple. I am that I am. You remember that I am is a to-be verb. And so God simply said to him that I am the self-existent one. I am who I am. And there is another like me. I am eternal. Since I am eternal, I am unchangeable. I self-exist. I am full of light. I make darkness. I am who I am. So his authority is God. And so all the way through, when Moses stands before the children of Israel, he says to them, I am sent me. God sent me. And then we know, of course, that Christ used that phrase repeatedly, especially reported to us in John's Gospel, and obviously referring back to this where Jesus said, I am. I am the light, and I am the truth, and I am the door, and I am the way, and so forth. I am before Abraham was. Abraham was before Moses several hundred years. So I am before Abraham was. How could that be? They questioned in that day, because he is the one who has self-authority. We have no self-authority. Moses had no self-authority. God has self-authority. So Moses said, I'm without importance. I'm without authority. And then his third protest will come in for the fourth chapter, and that's what brings us to chapter 4. So I'm without importance, I'm without authority, and then let's read verse 1 in verse number 4, chapter number 4, and you'll see this yourself. And Moses answered and said, But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord hath not appeared unto thee. They're going to refuse to believe that the Lord has appeared. So he says, I'm without importance, without authority. I am without believability. There's no reason for them to believe me. Who am I that they will believe me? And so God's going to answer all of these things, of course, and we'll come to that in a minute. But I want to show you one more protest that Moses raises up. In verse number 10, Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. So if you take these protests apart and you look at them, you can see that Moses doesn't want to do this. He's got his heels dug in. He doesn't want to do this. I am not a good speaker. So it's out of this, out of these protests, that God is going to give to Moses an education. You and I might feel the same way. I'm not able to do what you're calling me to do. I'm not able to perform what you're calling me to. Who am I that I would do this? But if God calls you, he also equips you. If God calls you, he prepares you to do what it is that he's calling you to do. So now I want you to see proofs. There are four proofs that God gives that are answers to Moses' protest. So what are the proofs that God gives to him? Well, the first proof has to do with a rod turning into a snake. So if you'll look in verse number 2, chapter 4 in verse 2, here is the first proof. The Lord said unto him, What is that that is in thine hand? You can imagine Moses turned his head, looked at his hand, and he had a rod there. That rod would have been a strong piece of wood that would have stretched from his hand down to the ground, so maybe 4 feet long. I don't really know how long it was, but long enough for Moses to reach to the ground. He said, well, it's a rod. And then God said, cast it on the ground. And so Moses cast it on the ground, and as suddenly as he did that, it became a serpent. Moses did what anybody in their right mind would do. He jumped back. He fled from it, got away from the snake. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand and take it. Now, if you're going to pick up a snake, I don't know much about handling snakes for sure, but if you're going to pick up a snake, where would you pick it up? Well, you'd pick it up behind the head. So you'd want to be quick, eyes big and open, and you would want to catch that snake behind the head, because then you're getting a handle on the biting end. So then you've got him by the head, and he can't turn and bite you. But if you grab him by the tail, what's he going to do? Well, he's going to turn, and he's going to put his teeth into you. But God very carefully says to him, take the snake by the tail. Well, Moses, again, is a man of faith, so he put forth his hand, and he caught it, meaning he did it just like God had told him, and as quickly as he laid his hand up on that snake, it became a rod in his hand. And then verse 5 says that they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, hath appeared unto thee. So the first thing that God does, it gives him a proof through the snake. But then God's going to do more than that. The second proof that he gives him has to do with leprosy. So if you look in verse 6, and the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now thine hand into thy bosom. So you have a robe on, put it inside your robe, close to your body. And he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. I think that that means that that's leprosy that is mature, leprosy that is full grown. It's not beginning. So all of a sudden, his hand was absolutely leprous. So then he said to him in verse number 7, put thy hand into thy bosom again. I think I'd be hesitant to do that, wouldn't you? Put a leper's hand next to my stomach. But he put his hand into his bosom again, and he plucked it out of his bosom, and behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. And it came to pass, if they will not, and it shall come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of that great sign, they will believe the voice of the latter sign. And then he gives him another in verse 9. So this would be the third one. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto thy voice, that thou shalt take the water of the river and pour it upon dry land, and the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land. So there's your third proof that God gives him. But there is still one more that is to come. And that is that God declares that he is sovereign. Notice verse 10. And Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither hitherto nor since have spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, who made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or the deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth, and I will teach thee what thou shalt say. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him who thou wilt send. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well, and also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. And when he seeth thee, he will be glad in his heart, and thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth, and I will be with his mouth, and I will be with thy mouth, and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do. And he shall be thy spokesman unto the people, and he shall be unto thee instead of thy mouth, thou shalt be to him instead of God. And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand therewith, and do the signs. Now we read a little earlier in Psalm 135. Did Brother Randy do an able and good job reading the scriptures to us? In verse number 6, it says, "Whatsoever the Lord pleased, that did he in heaven and in earth and in the sea as in all the deep places. And he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth and makes lightnings for the rain and brings forth wind out of his treasuries." What is it that the psalmist is declaring? The psalmist is declaring that God is sovereign. What is it that God is declaring to Moses? He is declaring that he is sovereign. He will do what he pleases, with whom he pleases, when he pleases, as he pleases, and he does it that way all the time. He is the maker of all of us, giving us our abilities, making us and our personality like we are, putting us in the family that he did. Now, we might wish it were different, but the best thing we can do is take it like it is and thank God that he is sovereign and now that he has brought us to this place of understanding. That is the fourth proof. He turned the rod into a snake. He turned the hand into leprosy. He told him that he would turn water into blood. And now he declares to him that I am sovereign and I will do what I please. And you have a brother, and that brother is going to become your spokesman. Well, out of all of this, because we're talking about the education of Moses, are we not? God has called him. God's given to him faith. And now God is educating him in what he is going to do. So you've seen some protest and you've seen some proofs. And now what we're going to see is Moses is given some plans. So I want you to see about four or five things that are here. The first thing is that Moses plans to depart from his father-in-law. In verse number 18. And Moses went and returned unto Jethro, his father-in-law, and said unto him, "Let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now, I need to first of all say a word about something back in chapter 2 and verse 18, where Moses first of all meets these girls, and then they're going to take him to their father. And we're told that the name of their father in verse 18 is Reuel, their father. And so over here, his name is Jethro. Never again does that name Reuel appear, but it suggested two things that I read. First of all, that Reuel is maybe a family name, a clan name. That could be so. It also could be the grandfather's name. So it could have been referring to the father that's the head of the clan. So one of those two things most likely is it, because both of those things would have been true. But Jethro is the name that's going to be followed through the rest of the book. We can only speculate, but either of those names suffices, at least my way of thinking. But I do want you to notice something here. God has told Moses very clearly that you're going to go back and you are going to be the instrument that is going to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt. But when he speaks to Jethro, he simply says to him that I want to go back and I want to see if they are yet alive. Moses seems hesitant to totally announce what it is that he's going to do. I don't think he's denying what he's going to do, but he's not saying precisely what he's going to do. So he says to his father-in-law, I'm going back to see if they are yet alive. Well, it's a hard thing to leave his father-in-law. He's been there for 40 years. A good father-in-law is hard to come by. And so he's hesitant to leave his father-in-law. So I think this must have been a traumatic experience for Moses along the way. But then he also has a plan that he is going to meet up with Pharaoh. So look in verse 21. He's going to face Pharaoh. And the Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return to Egypt, see that thou do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in thy hand. but I will harden his heart. Now that'll become an important phrase that we'll look at more in the next couple of weeks. This is the first time that this is said, and it'll become an important phrase. I will harden his heart, that he will not let the people go. And thou shalt say unto the Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn. Well, that will become literally true. We know that, do we not? But right now, Moses is planning to face Pharaoh, and it's not going to be an easy time. Now, in verse number 24, down through verse 26, Moses has a plan, or I don't know exactly what to call this, but it is to defraud God. So he's going to depart from Jethro and to face Pharaoh, but then you have him defrauding God. So we're going to come back to that. That'll be the last thing I'll talk about. I want you to go with me to the fourth thing, and that is he has plans to meet Aaron. So look down to verse 27. And the Lord said to Aaron, so now you have Moses. Moses is in Midian. I think we estimated that was maybe about 200 miles away. But now Moses has spoken to his father-in-law, and he's begun his journey with his family on his way. But while he's going in a different place over in Egypt, the Lord spoke to Aaron. So here these 200 or so miles away, now God is preparing what is going to take place. So what you and I cannot see at any one time, we cannot see what God is doing with us exactly, and we cannot see what God is doing to prepare a circumstance in another place. Isn't that wonderful? I think it's absolutely wonderful that here you see the providence of God, that he speaks to Aaron and he tells him, I want you to go into the wilderness and you're going to meet Moses. I don't know what he thought about that. We're not told, but he must have been startled to hear the name Moses. I want you to go into the wilderness and you're going to meet Moses. And he went and he met him in the Mount of God, and he kissed him. It's a way of saying they were warm, friendly toward each other, brotherly love. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. And so he meets with Aaron. He has one more thing to his plan, and that is to meet with the elders. And that's in 29 through 31. Moses and Aaron went and gathered all the children of the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke, just like God said. He spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. I guess Moses did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, that they had looked upon their affliction, that they bowed their heads and they worshiped. Isn't that a wonderful way to end that chapter? They bowed their heads and they worshiped. But I need to go back and talk with you about this one thing. I only have about 3 or 4 minutes, so I can only say a few things. I want to talk with you about Moses defrauding God. I want you to look in verse number 24, 20 through 26. And it came to pass, by the way, in the end. So Moses and his family have left Jethro. They're headed toward Egypt. And the Lord met him, and notice this, and sought to kill him. God sought to kill Moses. In verse 25, then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said to Moses, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. Verse 26, so he let him go. That is, God let him go. Then she said a second time, a bloody husband art thou because of the circumcision. Now this is a strange thing to us. And I use the word defraud. Here's what the word defraud means very simply. It means deception. So either by purpose or by neglect, Moses was not following God's instructions, because this matter of circumcision had gone all the way back to Abraham and was still practiced by the Israelites and still practiced by the Midianites. Now you have to remember that Moses had not been raised by either one. He had been raised as an Egyptian. And so Moses was not given over all the way to this practice. Now the important thing about the circumcision is that it is the early shedding of blood. And it is the shedding of the blood that the circumcision is really all about. The circumcision is that the shedding of the blood, and you are under the covenant of God. Now, in time, we know that the circumcision had simply become a ritual. It simply was a ritual to them, and they had lost sight of what it meant by the shedding of the blood and by being under the covenant. How important was this blood and this covenant? Well, so important that God considered killing Moses. How was this accomplished? Well, of course, by shedding of the blood, because two times she tells him that he's a bloody husband. And how effectual was it? Well, it was totally effectual, because in the circumcision, like it was supposed to be done, she could say to him that you are under the blood. That's what she's saying to him. This is not meant to be a condemning way, but an assuring way. Zipporah stepped in and did what needed to be done and actually delivered him. And so she could say, you are under the blood. Now, I want you to turn with me very quickly. I know I've got to stop real fast, but I want you to turn with me real quickly to Luke 2, Luke chapter 2. And I want you to look, please, at verse number 21. Luke 2 and 21. This is the early days of Jesus' birth. And now he's just a small baby wrapped in these swaddling clothes. And verse 21, Luke 2, and when 8 days were accomplished for the circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was so named by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. And so Jesus was circumcised. His blood was shed. This is the first shedding of blood. This is the first act of obedience. The legalists, the Pharisees, scribes, Sadducees, had all turned this, as I said, away from blood redemption to be just a religious ritual. Moses failed to understand or properly consider the shedding of the blood, but he will come to understand. Neither he nor his sons were exempt or safe outside of the blood and the covenant. The only safety in all of the world is being under the blood. That's the only place. And being under the blood is a free and sovereign act of the sovereign God. The great I Am took the blood of his son, and by the blood of his son, he declared, you are a bloody child of mine. You are under the blood. And I hope that God has given you faith so that you can rest in that one simple message.